Well, good morning, everyone. It's great to be here. I do have a slightly funny accent, as you can tell, but I do speak very good English, so I hope you'll be able to understand me well enough. I do apologize for not being here yesterday morning, as I was scheduled to be. You probably heard that my car broke down on the way driving here yesterday morning. I guess in light of the theme of the conference, I should say that I was providentially hindered. And what a hindrance it was when my engine cut out at 70 miles per hour on the interstate. But I'm very thankful to God that I didn't get all that far before that happened, and that I didn't cause an accident, because it could indeed have happened. But it is part of the Lord's purposes that I'm here this morning. Instead of yesterday morning, I'm particularly thankful to Dr. Piper for stepping in and filling my slot yesterday morning. We're going to be dealing with some difficult concepts, some difficult ideas in this lecture that I'm about to give. So if you would, please pray with me. Let's ask for the Lord's help. Our Father in heaven, as we consider some difficult matters, difficult issues that push us to the bounds of our knowledge and to the bounds of your revelation, I pray that you would help us to use our minds well, that you would grant us understanding where understanding is available to us, and that you would grant us contentment at those points where we simply have to rest in mystery and in our trust of your word. So we pray you'll bless this time and help me to speak clearly and faithfully, and may it all be for your glory. In Christ's name, amen. Amen. According to the Bible, the entire human race is fallen in sin and subject to death because of the first transgression of the first member of that race. The Apostle Paul wrote to the church in Rome that sin entered the world through one man and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. Historically, the notion of a first human sin has proven important in the services of Christian theodicy. Skeptics naturally ask, if God created the universe and created humans in his own image, then why is the human race in such a sorry state? Why do we treat each other so abominably? Why do we suffer sickness and death? Why do so many of us experience such misery, not least at each other's hands? The Christian doctrine of the fall, centered on a first human sin, supplies a relatively straightforward answer. Adam was the fountainhead and representative of the human race. He was created good and free to choose between good and evil, to obey or to disobey God's commandments. At some point in time, for reasons that we may never understand, Adam chose evil over good. He rebelled against his creator, and in so doing, he corrupted human nature and brought the penalty of death upon himself and his progeny. However, despite its potential for theodicy, the notion of an Adamic fall raises some difficult questions, does it not? Some of these questions concern the relationship between Adam and his progeny. How did sin corrupt not only Adam, but all of mankind? Why should you and I suffer today because of the single transgression of a distant ancestor? Perhaps the most perplexing question of all is one that has been put to me in this form. Daddy, if God made Adam good, why did he go bad? Why indeed? The mystery of the first sin is one that must be faced by Christians of all theological traditions. But many would say that of all Christians, those of us who are called Calvinists face the most intractable problems when accounting for the first sin. And these problems are traced to our commitment to divine determinism, the view that everything that takes place in the creation is ultimately determined solely by the decree of God. According to historical Reformed theology, God has an eternal decree that encompasses all things. God sovereignly foreordains all things, including the free choices of his creatures. And that would include, of course, Adam's original sin, his free choice to rebel against his creator. Let me remind you of some relevant statements from the Westminster Confession of Faith as representative of the Reformed tradition. First, chapter 3, article 1. God from all eternity did, by the most wise and holy counsel of his own will, freely and unchangeably ordain whatsoever comes to pass. Yet so as thereby neither is God the author of sin, nor is violence offered to the will of the creature, nor is the liberty or contingency of second causes taken away, but rather established. Then chapter 5, first two articles. God, the great creator of all things, doth uphold, direct, dispose, and govern all creatures, actions, and things, from the greatest even to the least, by his most wise and holy providence, according to his infallible knowledge and the free and immutable counsel of his own will, to the praise of his glory, of his wisdom, power, justice, goodness, and mercy. In relation to the foreknowledge and decree of God, the first cause, all things come to pass immutably and infallibly. And then from the fourth article of the same chapter, the almighty power, unsearchable wisdom, and infinite goodness of God so far manifest themselves in his providence that it extendeth itself even to the first fall and all other sins of angels and men, and that not by a bare permission, but such as hath joined it with a most wise and powerful bounding and otherwise ordering and governing of them in a manifold dispensation to his own holy ends. So we see what the Reformed position is on this traditionally. But what are these problems, these supposed problems that Calvinists have to face when it comes to the first sin? Well, in this lecture, I want to focus on two in particular. First, there is the claim that Calvinism makes God the author of sin. And not just the author of sin in general, but the author of the first sin, from which all other sins derive. Here's how the objection is typically developed. If God determines all things by his eternal decree, then it follows that God determined the first human sin. God did not merely foreknow that Adam would sin. He didn't merely allow that Adam would sin with what the confession calls a bare permission, a kind of hands-off, uninvolved approach. No, God determined that Adam would sin. That is to say, God decreed that Adam would sin and that his decree was the ultimate cause of Adam's sin. On the Calvinist view, then, God intentionally caused, in some sense, the first sin. But that would make God the author of sin. So this argument goes, so the objection runs. But to say that God is the author of sin, that's incompatible with God's moral perfection, his holiness, which is an essential tenet of Christian theism. That is the first problem. Second, there is the claim that on the Calvinist view, Adam's sin is inexplicable. And the reasoning in this case runs like this. Calvinists must be committed to a compatibilist view of human freedom. Compatibilism is the view that human freedom and moral responsibility are compatible with determinism. Our choices can be both free and determined for the compatibilist. Now, generally speaking, in compatibilist accounts of free will, a person's choice at some time is sufficiently explained by his internal state, his character, his beliefs, his desires, dispositions, so forth, and also on his external circumstances, how he's reacting to them. So, for example, if I go to Dunkin' Donuts on a Thursday evening, and I find myself in circumstances where the only donuts that they have left are Boston creams and caramel spices, and I freely choose a Boston cream, that choice is sufficiently explained by the circumstances that I find myself in, and also my internal state at that moment. I have certain tastes when it comes to donuts. And I know that on the basis of my past experience, I'll get a lot more pleasure out of the Boston cream. As Calvinists have often put the point, we choose according to our strongest desires. We choose according to our strongest desires. Our strongest desires thus explain our choices in conjunction with the circumstances. Now, in the case of Adam's first sin, while the external circumstances included a malicious tempter, the serpent, that outside influence alone cannot be a sufficient explanation for Adam's sin. Otherwise, he couldn't be held morally responsible. Just the presence of the tempter guaranteed that he would sin. Then we would not hold him morally responsible, even as compatibilists. And yet, Adam's internal state prior to that first sin was wholly good. He had no evil desires or dispositions. On the contrary, he was, by nature, by creation, wholly disposed toward good. And so Adam's sin appears to be inexplicable on a compatibilist basis, given the various external and internal causes. There appears to be no sufficient causal explanation for Adam's sin. Daddy, if God made Adam good, why did he go bad? Well, on the face of it, these are significant challenges for Calvinists. But I want to argue here that Calvinism, even if it is a form of divine determinism, doesn't necessarily give rise to these two problems, at least not to the degree that one could dismiss Calvinism as philosophically and theologically untenable. Furthermore, I will suggest that while Calvinism does face some difficult questions, the alternatives to Calvinism face problems of their own that are no less perplexing. And my overall contention is that when the Calvinist account of the first sin is compared with competing accounts on a level playing field where all the pros and cons of each account are considered, the Calvinist account has considerably more in its favor than the alternatives. Now, before I address these two problems that I've outlined here, I need to say something about what it means for Calvinists to be committed to divine determinism. I think we ought to concede at the outset that Calvinism is indeed committed to divine determinism, the view that everything ultimately is determined by God. I've already cited the Westminster Divines on this point. I could also quote from the original Calvinist, John Calvin, and I could cite from other Reformed theologians for support on this point. Now, while these various theologians may not use the exact phrase divine determinism, it's clear enough that they think that every event finds its origin in the eternal decree of God. For every event that takes place in the creation, God has decided from eternity that that event will take place, and God's decision, God's decree, was the ultimate sufficient cause of that event. That is to say, if God wills that an event occur, then that in itself is sufficient for that event to occur, by some means or other. And this is an original thought to the Reformers. There are prior theologians such as Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, who hold the same basic view. What is more, I think we should say that this divine determinism is a kind of causal determinism in the broad sense. Calvinists want to say that God is the first cause of all things, and that God's sovereign decree is the ultimate sufficient cause of every event that occurs in the creation. God certainly makes use of second causes. We see that in the confession. But God alone is the first cause. There are no other first causes alongside God. Well, that being the case, how should we understand this divine causal determinism? What exactly are Calvinists committed to here? Well, if you've read anything in contemporary philosophy, if you're familiar with contemporary debates in metaphysics, you'll be aware that the very idea of causation is controversial and hotly debated. Explaining what causation is in general is difficult enough, never mind the idea of divine causation. But even so, we all have a basic intuitive idea of what it means for one thing to cause another, for one event to bring about another event. I kick the ball, which causes the ball to fly into the air. I reverse my truck into your brand new BMW, which causes a large dent, which in turn causes you to swing your fist at my face, which causes a large dent. Causation. We're familiar with it. However, we mustn't simply assume that divine causation is similar in every way, or even in most ways, to those kinds of causation that we routinely experience in the world. Divine causation is surely not on a par with creaturely causation, causation within the creation, the sorts of causation that I just gave some illustrations of. Divine causation is unique in a number of respects. For example, we as causal agents can bring about changes in things that already exist. But unlike God, we do not have at our disposal the kind of causation that can bring things into existence ex nihilo and sustain them in their existence or completely annihilate them, remove their existence. So that's several differences right there. Creaturely causes have a location in time and in space. God does not. God is an utterly unique, transcendent cause. One of the basic tenets of a Christian worldview, of a biblical worldview, is the creator-creation distinction. The creator is ontologically distinct from the creation. God in his essence is completely transcendent. Well, in light of the creator-creation distinction, we should recognize then that divine causation is of a wholly different order than creaturely causation. It operates on a level of its own. Divine causation is related only analogically to creaturely causation. There are points of similarity, for sure, but there are also significant points of dissimilarity, discontinuity. For this reason, when we talk about God as the first cause and as the ultimate sufficient cause, we should not be misled into thinking that Calvinism is committed to what we might call the domino model of providence. I'm sure you're familiar with the elaborate domino toppling feats that break world records from time to time. In such displays, tens of thousands of domino pieces are meticulously arranged such that each will be caused to fall in its proper sequence by the toppling of a preceding domino. And these schemes, if you've seen this sort of thing on the TV or perhaps on YouTube, these schemes are typically initiated by the fall of a single initial domino, which is pushed over by a human agent. And if all goes to plan, then the human agent only needs to directly cause the first domino to fall, and then everything follows from that. And it makes sense to say, in that sort of scenario, that the human agent is both the first cause and the sufficient cause of every domino fall, either directly, with the first one, or indirectly. Now, one might be tempted to think of divine providence in such terms. God creates and arranges a complex system of dominoes, the universe of second causes in its initial state, in its original state, and he initiates his providential plan with a flick of the divine finger, so to speak. And since God isn't obliged always to work through second causes, God may choose to directly start some chains of dominoes at later times, or even to directly interrupt some chains. It's his prerogative. Well, the domino model of providence can be diagrammed like this. You have a series of causes in sequence. God is the first cause, and then God causes one event, which causes another event, which causes another event. The E here signifies an event within the creation, and the arrows indicate causation. That was what the domino model would look like. Now, does this model represent how a Calvinist ought to think about divine providence? Are Calvinists committed to something like this domino model? I want to say, no, not at all. This model is badly flawed because it fails to reflect the reality that divine causation operates at a fundamentally different level than creaturely causation. You see, in the domino model, the lines of causation are entirely horizontal. They all operate on the same ontological plane. On this way of thinking, God and the universe amount to an arrangement of univocal causal chains. The same type of causation just following along the chain. But Calvinists aren't committed to anything like such a model. In fact, I believe we ought to firmly repudiate it in light of our high doctrine of God. A far better model would be what we might call the authorial model of providence. The authorial model of providence. On this view, God's acts of creation and providence are taken as analogous to the human authoring of a novel. Just think about the relationship between a human author and his literary work. At the ultimate level, the author determines everything that takes place in his novel. He creates a world, and he populates it with characters. Indeed, he creates the characters. In a relative sense, he brings them into existence. And he bestows them with certain personalities and causal powers. And those need not correspond to the causal powers in his own world. Think of fantasy and science fiction genres where creatures can have different kinds of powers. And the author sets up the circumstances in which the characters live and play out their roles in some overarching storyline. At least that's how novels used to be written. They used to have a storyline. Now, in the story, some of the characters may commit morally objectionable, even wicked actions. Actions which the author himself disapproves, but which are necessary for the sake of the story and its outcome. J.R.R. Tolkien presumably did not morally approve of Gollum's actions in The Lord of the Rings, But the novels would hardly have been the same without Gollum and his schemes. As we all recognize, a good story can contain bad characters who commit wicked acts. Indeed, one could argue that a truly good story would have to contain some such elements. We might say then that the author of the novel has ordained that sinful actions take place within the world that he has created, but the author himself does not thereby commit any sinful actions or imply his approval of them. In a broad sense then, the novelist is the first and ultimate sufficient cause of everything that takes place in his creation. And yet, and this is the point, at the same time, this authorial causation operates on a very different level than the intra-narrative causes. That is, the causes within the narrative, within the storyline itself. After all, it's not as though an Oxford Don appears in Middle Earth and places the One Ring on Sméagol's finger. I hope you can see that. I had a lot of fun creating that, as you can imagine. But to say that sort of thing would be a confusion. It would be a crude confusion of levels between the author and the story. Now, the authorial model of providence can be diagrammed like this, by contrast. In the authorial model, God isn't merely one cause in a chain of horizontal causes. On the contrary, divine causation is of a fundamentally different order than creaturely causation. And indeed, it is foundational to it in every respect. And with this sort of model in mind, we can draw a fundamental distinction between divine causation and creaturely causation. What I've labeled in this diagram, alpha causation and beta causation. Don't be put off by that. It's just what philosophers do. We attach Greek symbols to things to make us sound more clever than we really are. It's just convenience here. Alpha causation is divine causation. Beta causation is causation within the creation. And here's how these two kinds of causation relate. God alpha causes every creature to exist in the first place and to continue to exist. God sustains the creature's existence with alpha causation. And God alpha causes every creature to have the beta causal powers that it has. Creatures have their own causal powers. And God also, I think we want to say, God alpha causes every creature to exercise its beta causal powers in precisely the way that it does, so that events take place just as God has foreordained. Now, I hope it's clear enough that this authorial model of providence captures the creator-creation distinction in a way that the domino model of providence doesn't. However, the authorial model does not rule out the possibility of God acting on the horizontal level, so to speak, as an agent alongside creaturely agents. Just as an author can write himself into his own novel, appearing as one character among others, it's a literary technique known as self-insertion, so God can write himself into the creational storyline as a character. And of course, that's exactly what he has done. You find that in the scripture, and supremely in the incarnation itself. But the point is this, and understand this point. In the ordinary course of providence, God is acting as a transcendent divine cause on the vertical level rather than as a character in the story on a horizontal level, as that domino model suggests. Now, all of this is really by way of background, to get a little clearer on what exactly Calvinists are committed to in terms of divine determinism and how we might think about this divine determinism from a Calvinist perspective. So with that background behind us, now let's return to the two problems that I outlined earlier. There they are. First, there is the charge that Calvinism makes God the author of sin, including the original sin. Now, you might think that by advocating this authorial model of providence, I've spun the rope to hang myself and my fellow Calvinists, the rest of you as well. If God is the author of the entire creation and its storyline, does it not follow that God is the author of the sinful actions that take place within that creation? So doesn't this authorial model entail that God is the author of sin? Well, yes, in a sense. But as we've seen, there are morally unobjectionable senses in which someone can be the author of sin. For example, by authoring a novel in which sinful acts are committed, even though the author himself morally disapproves of those actions. I mean, we don't think any the worse of Tolkien because of what Gollum does. The real question is whether Calvinism implies that God is the author of sin in any morally or theologically objectionable sense, in any way that would be inconsistent with God's moral perfection, God's holiness. Now, the Westminster Divines, in the Confession, explicitly denied that God is the author of sin. It's right there in the Confession, chapter 5, article 4. But they also explicitly affirm that God foreordains all things, including sinful actions, even the fall of Adam. We saw that as well. So at a minimum, they would have granted that God is the author of sin in the relatively thin sense entailed by divine determinism. That is, that God determines by some causal means that in the course of history, certain sins will be committed by his creatures for his own holy and wise ends. So what exactly did the Westminster Divines mean to exclude when they denied that God is the author of sin? Well, we can get a good idea from what they say in the immediate context of that phrase in the Confession. Alongside this denial, we also find the denial that God is the approver of sin. God, being pure and holy, cannot take pleasure in or approve of sin as such, sin as sin. And again in the Confession, immediately preceding the denial that God is the author or approver of sin, the Confession also states that the sins of men and angels proceedeth only from the creature and not from God. That's what's said. They proceed only from the creature and not from God. The basic idea is that sin is always a creaturely action and never a divine action. Creatures commit evil acts, but God never commits evil acts, even though he foreordains the evil acts of his creatures. But that is not the same thing at all, to commit an act and foreordain an act. In terms of our earlier distinctions, we may say that creatures beta cause evil, but God never beta causes evil. God does, however, alpha cause the creatures beta causing of evil, as part of what the Confession calls his own holy ends. With those kind of distinctions, we can draw out that distinction, explain exactly what is being said here and what is not being said here. Now, at this point, someone might say, well, this is a distinction without a difference. Causes are causes. And if one person causes another person to do something evil, then that first person is the one who is culpable for that evil, blameworthy for that evil. Now, on the face of it, that seems like a reasonable principle, but it's one that turns out to be quite hard to justify philosophically. For example, think of a police sting operation. If the police set things up in such a way that a suspected criminal could not resist the opportunity to commit a robbery because of his greed, because of his bad character, would the police then become culpable for the robbery? No. Furthermore, one does not have to be the cause of an evil to be culpable for it. You can be culpable by not causing something. Think of the zookeeper who, by negligence, leaves open the door of the lion cage so that the lion escapes and mauls some visitors. The keeper does not cause the lion to maul them, but he's still culpable because he didn't cause something. He did not cause the door to be closed. That being the case, it does seem that non-Calvinists aren't in any easier position than Calvinists, because they have to grant that God knowingly and willingly permits the evil actions of his creatures. He does not intervene to prevent those actions. But the point that I really want to emphasize is that we cannot simply take principles from our own experience of the creation, including principles about causation, and apply them without qualification to the relationship between God and his creation. We have to take into account the creator-creation distinction. And as I've emphasized, divine causation operates at a different level than creaturely causation. And it differs from creaturely causation in significant respects, including God's moral relationship to the sins of his creatures. My point is this. If the authorial model of providence is close to the mark, why think that the divine author must be culpable for realizing a novel in which the characters commit sins? As best as I can tell, then, divine causal determinism, as such, does not entail that God is the author of sin in any morally or theologically objectionable sense. And of course, the first sin is no different than any other sin in this regard. In the end, what is widely regarded as a grave problem for Calvinism, that it makes God the author of sin, only appears to be a problem while that term author is left ambiguous and unanalyzed. That's usually what happens when people say, you make God the author of sin. They're not really defining what that term means. And once you tease out some of the different senses, you can see that the problem vanishes. Or at least it's no greater a problem for Calvinism than any other position. So that's the first problem addressed. But second, there's the problem of the inexplicability of Adam's sin. Let me remind you of the problem here. Calvinists, it is said, are committed to a compatibilist account of human freedom. And according to such accounts, when a person makes a free choice, that choice is sufficiently explained by that person's internal state and his external circumstances at that moment of choice. Remember my choice in about the Boston cream donut. But in the case of unfallen Adam, his internal state was unfallen. It was wholly good. He had no sinful dispositions, inclinations, or character traits. God didn't put those in him. So what on earth could explain why Adam would choose to sin? It appears that Adam's sin was inexplicable in terms of his internal state and his external circumstances. That's the problem. Well, the first thing to be said in response is that while Calvinists are indeed committed to the view that human freedom is compatible with divine determinism, we are not committed to any particular compatibilist account of human freedom. Philosophers have offered various compatibilist accounts, but a Calvinist isn't forced to accept any particular one of them. And Calvinists in particular need not be committed to the view that a person's choice has to be sufficiently explained by his internal state and his external circumstances. Many compatibilists will say that, but Calvinists don't have to agree with that. Nevertheless, the Calvinist will want to affirm that there is an ultimate sufficient explanation for Adam's sin, and it is simply this: God decreed it. God decreed it, and he decreed it for the purpose of manifesting his glory in both his judgment and his mercy. It's what we find, Ephesians chapter 1, Romans chapter 9. Still, that kind of ultimate explanation doesn't seem to be like the sort of explanation we're really looking for here. I mean, God also decreed that Barack Obama would win the 2012 presidential election. We know it, because it happened. On one level, that explains why it happened. God decreed it. But it doesn't really explain why more Americans chose to vote for Obama than they did to vote for Mitt Romney. Now, at this point, I must confess that further answers are not readily forthcoming. For many Calvinists, the idea that our choices are sufficiently explained by our internal state and our external circumstances does actually help to explain other biblical doctrines, such as the doctrine of total depravity and the doctrine of efficacious grace or effectual calling. That sort of understanding of human free will does help when it comes to those doctrines. But on that view of free choice, it really is hard to explain the first human sin. How could unfallen Adam's internal states, his beliefs, his desires, his dispositions, his motivations, and so forth, how could they have given rise to a sinful choice? However, while recognizing the difficulty, it's important to consider both sides of the question here. Has anyone shown that unfallen Adam's internal states could not have given rise to a sinful choice? I actually think that the burden of proof here lies on the critics of Calvinism, who need to show that on any compatibilist account, a sinful act must arise from some prior sinful state. But as far as I know, no one has proven that. Now, no doubt it would be extremely unlikely on any compatibilist account for unfallen Adam to freely sin. It's going to be extremely unlikely. But while God cannot foreordain impossible events, surely God is entirely at liberty to foreordain improbable events. And the Bible is full of them. Every miracle. And it's important to recognize as well that Calvinism isn't the only view under consideration here. It's not the only view that deserves scrutiny. We need to ask whether the alternatives fare any better in explaining the first human sin. Can they offer any better account of why it is that unfallen Adam sinned? The short answer, I believe, is no, they cannot. And here's the reason why. What all the alternatives to Calvinism have in common is a commitment to a libertarian view of free will, as contrasted with a compatibilist view. A libertarian view of free will, according to which our free choices cannot be determined by any prior causes, including God's decree. That's what a libertarian view of free will says, that our choices can't be determined by prior causes. Libertarian freedom is indeterministic freedom. Indeterministic freedom. On this view, human free choices have an element of indeterminism. But here's the problem for those alternatives that take that view of free will. If a deterministic account, like the Calvinist one, cannot easily explain unfallen Adam's choice, how on earth could introducing indeterminism into the mix improve matters? On an indeterministic view, there's no sufficient explanation for any human free choice. Never mind the special case of Adam's choice. Indeterminism does not add anything to a causal explanation any more than appealing to brute chance adds anything to a causal explanation. And so it seems to me that non-Calvinists who hold to libertarian freedom are no better placed to solve this problem than the Calvinist. The fact is that the entrance of sin into the world is a fundamental mystery. And if Calvinism is unable to fully resolve that mystery, that's no argument against Calvinism, for the alternatives to Calvinism are no better placed to resolve it. Christians ought to recognize that there are many unresolved mysteries in our faith that we embrace, not because they are mysterious, but because they are unavoidable for those who are committed to Scripture as the Word of God. It is enough to know that what is mysterious to us is not mysterious to God. Well, as I noted a few moments ago, it's important to recognize that when objections are raised against Calvinism, we need to ask about the alternatives. We need to ask whether the alternatives to Calvinism do any better in avoiding those objections or other serious objections. If Calvinism is going to be subjected to a philosophical critique, it would be wrong to treat it in isolation. It has to be evaluated alongside the alternatives. And so in this last section of my presentation this morning, I want to consider just one major alternative to Calvinism and to ask the question whether it does any better in avoiding the problems and perplexities of the first sin. Now, of course, there are various alternatives, and if we had more time, we could look at them, and a few places I've written on them. But for now, I just want to consider one alternative, and that is the position known as Molinism. Molinism. As a theory of divine providence, Molinism is arguably the closest competitor and the most significant alternative to Calvinism, the most serious competitor. Molinism was a theory originally developed in the 16th century by a Spanish Jesuit theologian, Luis de Molina, that's him on the left of the screen, as an alternative. He developed it as an alternative to Augustinian and Thomistic views of divine predestination and human freedom. However, in the last 50 years or so, Molinism has grown in popularity, not just among Roman Catholics, but among evangelicals, as it has been promoted by influential Christian philosophers such as Alvin Plantinga and William Lane Craig. What is Molinism, though? Molinism is essentially an attempt to reconcile the doctrine of divine providence, God's comprehensive governance of all things within the creation, to reconcile that with a libertarian view of human freedom, according to which our choices are not causally determined. And the way that Molinism tries to accomplish this reconciliation is by appealing to the idea of God's middle knowledge. God's middle knowledge. According to the Molinist, God's knowledge has three logical moments to it. It can be divided into three sequential categories. Now, this diagram here might be a little bit intimidating at first. Don't worry too much about it, and I'm sorry that some of the text is a little on the small side, but I'll be explaining the important parts of it as we go. Just wanted to give you something to look at while I talk about this. So, according to the Molinist, God's knowledge has three logical moments. The first logical moment is God's natural knowledge. This is grounded in God's nature, in his essence. And that includes God's knowledge of all possibilities, all logical possibilities. The third moment is God's free knowledge. And that is grounded in his will, in God's free will. And that that free knowledge includes God's knowledge of the actual world, the world that he has created. This is the knowledge that logically follows God's decree of creation. So you see that God's decree of creation is slotted in there between the second and the third moments. And between these two moments of natural knowledge and free knowledge, you have God's middle knowledge. God's middle knowledge is his hypothetical knowledge of what any possible creature would do when placed in any possible set of circumstances. This is a kind of knowledge that God has prior to his decree to create. And his decision, God's decision about what world to create, is based in part on this middle knowledge. And in fact, it's actually constrained by the content of this middle knowledge. And so even before God's decree to create, God's decision to create, the Molinist says that there are truths about what I would do if God were to create me and to put me in certain circumstances. Even before God has decided whether he'll create me or you or anyone else, God knows what any possible creature would do in any possible circumstances. And so the content of this middle knowledge would have a truth about, for example, what kind of donut I would choose if God were to create me and arrange for me to be in Dunkin' Donuts on a particular time and date in my life, given everything else in my life. Now, these truths that are the content of middle knowledge are something like brute facts about possible creatures that God knows somehow, but they aren't determined by God. God doesn't determine the content of his middle knowledge. It's as it were, handed to him. They're just brute facts about what these creatures would do. These truths do not depend on God's nature, and they do not depend on God's free decree either. These are truths independent of God. They're brute facts independent of God. And they constrain the kind of worlds that God is able to bring about. And so according to the Molinist, God knows all the possible worlds that there could be on the basis of his natural knowledge, but his middle knowledge tells him which of these possible worlds he could actually bring about by creating particular people with libertarian free will and arranging for them to make their choices in particular circumstances, predetermined circumstances, so that they will freely choose exactly what God has planned for them to choose. That's the theory. And so on this Molinist view, God does plan and govern every event in the creation. Everything turns out according to his eternal decree, but his control over the free choices of his creatures is indirect rather than direct. He directs those choices by meticulously arranging circumstances in light of this middle knowledge that he is said to possess. That's the theory. Now, one of the attractive features of Molinism is that it does seek to do justice to what the Bible teaches about God's control over his creation. The Bible clearly teaches, from start to finish, that God has an eternal plan that covers all events within the creation, and that everything works out according to that plan. We saw that in the verses, for example, from Isaiah 46, read at the beginning. And this is known as the doctrine of meticulous providence, the doctrine of meticulous providence, sometimes known as the doctrine of comprehensive providence, every event. Molinists want to affirm that doctrine, but they want to affirm it while also affirming libertarian free will for human beings. They want to have their cake and to eat it too, we might say. Now, despite this positive aspect of Molinism, that it wants to do justice to the biblical doctrine of providence, Molinism does face a number of serious challenges, which I can't enter into here, and I believe my colleague Dr. Thomas addressed some of these in his lecture yesterday, so you have some idea of what these are. All I want to consider at this point is whether Molinism avoids the two problems that were posed earlier for Calvinism. We've seen what Calvinist answers might be, but how is a Molinist going to deal with these two problems? Start with the first. Does Molinism avoid making God the author of sin? Well, Molinists think so, because they reject causal determinism. And they say, well, we're not like those Calvinists, causal determinists. That's where your problem comes from. We don't affirm that, so this isn't a problem for us. But that is far too hasty. Because remember, on the Molinist view, God still has an eternal decree. And that eternal decree must come to pass. And that eternal decree encompasses every event within the creation, including every human sin. And that would include, of course, Adam's original sin. So, on the Molinist view, God has eternally decreed, he deliberately, knowingly, chose to actualize a world in which Adam would eat the forbidden fruit, and God's decree guaranteed that Adam would eat the fruit. Now, it's true that on the Molinist view, God didn't causally determine that Adam would sin in any sense, no causal determination there, but he did positively decree it. God created the world in such a way as to guarantee that Adam would sin. Indeed, God manipulated the circumstances so that Adam would inevitably sin. It's part of God's decree. How is that any less problematic on the face of it than the Calvinist view? Indeed, on the Molinist view, one might well just as well say that God is the author of history. God decides on a script for his creation, and the creation cannot fail to follow that script. And so God is no less the author of history, including Adam's fall, on the Molinist view than he is on the Calvinist view. Now, to be fair, the Molinist may have many things to say in response to the charge that he makes God the author of sin. The Molinist might respond that, well, God does not delight in sin for its own sake. He only uses it for his greater good purposes. Or he might say that God's intentions were pure in foreordaining Adam's sin, whereas Adam's intentions in sinning were not pure. And he might appeal to verses like Genesis 50, verse 22. You intended it for evil, but God intended it for good. Or the Molinist might point to the account of the crucifixion and say, Herod, Pontius Pilate, the Jews, the Gentiles, intended that for evil, but God intended it for good. But of course, Calvinists can say all those things too. All of the responses that a Molinist is likely to make, a Calvinist will make as well, and indeed made it before Molinism was ever invented. So it's far from clear that Molinism holds any advantages here. Calvinism no more makes God the author of sin in any morally objectionable sense than Molinism does. So much for the first problem. There's the second problem, the problem of the inexplicability of Adam's sin. Why would sinless Adam choose to sin? Does a Molinist have a better answer here? Well, I said that while Calvinism provides an ultimate answer, the eternal decree of God, we don't seem to have a good proximate answer to that question in terms of Adam's own makeup and circumstances. However, in my judgment, Molinism comes off even worse at this point. Let me explain. One of the distinguishing features of Molinism is its commitment to libertarian free will, according to which free choices cannot be determined by prior factors. But as I already pointed out, introducing indeterminism into the mix certainly doesn't help us to better understand why unfallen Adam would choose to sin. It's no more illuminating than appeal to sheer chance. And what is more, while Molinists do affirm that God has an eternal decree which lies behind all the events in creation, that eternal decree, on the Molinist view, is based in part on God's middle knowledge. This knowledge of brute facts about how possible creatures would act in particular circumstances. But these are brute facts that seem to have no grounding in God or in the creatures themselves. Because at this point, they're only possible creatures. The creatures themselves don't even exist when God has his middle knowledge. As Molinists themselves have sometimes put the point, when it comes to middle knowledge, God has to play the hand that he has dealt. Those possible worlds that he's able to actualize are beyond his control. So his middle knowledge is like God being dealt a hand of cards that he's then able to play. But there's no rhyme or reason behind the dealing of the cards. For all intents and purposes, it is a matter of sheer chance or luck that God gets dealt the hand of cards that he does get dealt, the worlds that he's able to actualize. Whereas on Calvinism, God has the freedom to choose from any possible world according to his good pleasure, on Molinism, God's choice of what world to actualize is restricted. And it's restricted in a way that has no apparent explanation. And so it seems to me that the Molinist is faced with even more mystery as to why we ended up in a world in which Adam sinned. Well, I've considered Molinism here because, as I've suggested, it is the closest competitor to Calvinism. There are other alternatives, such as the open theist view or the simple foreknowledge view, where God doesn't decree anything. He just foreknows what is going to happen. But these alternatives have much, much weaker views of divine providence, and thus they are unable to adequately account for the pervasive biblical data about God's comprehensive control over his creation. In a sense, Calvinism and Molinism are only serious choices when it comes to doctrine of divine providence. Well, some brief words in conclusion. The entrance of sin into the world is a mystery that all Christians have to face. And I've argued that the Calvinist view of divine providence, while it does face some philosophical challenges, is in no worse a position than any of its competitors. What is more, it has the following distinct advantages. First, it honors God's absolute sovereignty, independence, and freedom. Very high, exalted view of God. Second, it does not leave God dependent on brute facts beyond his control. Third, it offers an ultimate, sufficient explanation for the fall of Adam. God ordained it for his glory through the demonstration of both his mercy and his justice. And fourthly, it affirms without qualification the biblical doctrine of comprehensive divine providence. Winston Churchill famously quipped that democracy is the worst form of government except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. Well, like democracy, Calvinist theology has its challenges, and it may not satisfy at every point. Nevertheless, after fairly evaluating it alongside the alternatives, perhaps we should say this. Calvinism offers the worst account of the first sin, except for all those other accounts that have been tried from time to time. Thank you.